Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This Ben Jarofsky Show, Benny J. Bonus Interview, is brought to you in part by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, Local 126 and District 8, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 9, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150, and the Chicago Federation of Labor. Benny J., take it away.
Bonus time on the Ben Jarofsky Show, Wednesday, January 15th, 2020. But of course, it's a podcast, so you're listening at any time. This news could be really old news if you're listening to this and you're like, the year 2030. As we do with all bonus shows on the Ben Jarofsky Show, I ask my distinguished guest to introduce him or herself. So, distinguished guest, introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm David Ferris. I'm an associate professor of political science at Roosevelt University. And I wrote a book that I think you read, Ben, called It's Time to Fight Dirty: How Democrats Can Build a Lasting Majority in American Politics. So
that's correct.
Yeah, thank you, Robert Mueller. David Ferris wrote that book. I read it, I think it was 2 years ago, I want to say, and I've been having him on my shows ever since, talking politics. I have, I steal from you all the time. Although technically it's not stealing, because I generally give you attribution, so that's attribution. But I'm always like, well, Ferris says this. I get these Dems in here, and Ferris says this, and then to see what their reaction is. David has a couple of theorems. The big one is that Dems should fight like Republicans, and then he points out in his book how Republicans fight, and then of course he contrasts with the utter wimpiness of Democrats who are afraid of their shadow. I have a number of things I want to run down, David, on my list here. Yeah. I definitely want to talk about Iran and the insanity of our, I don't know if it's a war, a war of words, where we're at with that, how it gets played out politically as well. I want to talk about last night. Last night there was a debate. The Democrats had a debate, if you call it that, in Iowa.
Last debate before voting, you know?
Right, before the first caucus, or the first in the Democratic primaries. And then I want to talk to you about impeachment. So why don't we start with, oh gosh, let's start with last night's debate.
Yeah,
why not?
Let's do it.
Before we went on the air, you said it may have been the worst debate ever. You were talking in terms about the way CNN's moderators handle it. I might want to take issue with you because there have been some pretty bad debates, but explain why you think it was the worst debate ever.
So, I mean, over the course of this primary, I've become very frustrated with the moderation of these debates. You know, so this is not the first time, and it won't be the last. But I thought that last night in particular, the moderators seemed to just want to frame every question they asked Democrats in sort of the most right-wing way that they possibly could. You know, so it was, how are you going to pay for this? Convince us that you're not going to bankrupt us. How are you going to keep us safe? You know, will you prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon? Right, like all of these things are sort of like right or center-right ways of looking at the political universe. And so it's frustrating to me that Democrats as a party keep sort of voluntarily handing over their signature talent showcases to these sort of commercial entities who don't care about Democrats, and they don't care about progressivism, and they don't care about the future of the country. They care about ratings. You know, they want the candidates to fight, and they want to produce moments where the candidates are like squirming and they're like, I don't know how I'm going to pay for it. You know, or like, I feel like, of course I'll prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. Like they're all God and they can do that, you know. The central premises of a lot of these questions are absurd. Like, will Amy Klobuchar like personally go to Tehran and like defuse the first nuclear weapon? Like, give me a break, right? Yeah. Like, these are such absurd questions. I'm so glad that we don't have a record of debates in the 1990s where all of the candidates in all of the primaries were asked, like, will you prevent North Korea from getting will you personally prevent North Korea from getting a nuclear weapon? Like, will you go undercover?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's absurd because they did eventually get a nuclear weapon and we didn't stop them because we didn't want to go to war, you know? And so there's all this like subtext to these questions where you have built in assumptions that I think are quite conservative, you know, where the progressive candidates are constantly being asked to justify their policy positions. And then when the questioning turns to the moderate candidates, you know, some of whom I like perfectly fine. I work very hard for them if they are the nominee, but they never get pressed on it. You know, it's never like, hey, Pete, how are you going to pay for your plan for healthcare? You know, how are you going to pay for your childcare plan? He's just like, it's more moderate. I'll see you guys later. You know, and the moderators are like, oh, that sounds really, wow. You know, really sophisticated. Good job.
Well, let's go back to the foreign policy one, because there is an underlying assumption, and the underlying assumption is that the United States is all powerful and has the authority to determine whether Iran has the bomb. And there's an assumption embedded in that question that somehow or other, Donald John Trump is more convincing in using that authority than the Democrats, which I would argue, David, is utter fiction. Donald John Trump has no more authority in stopping Iran from building a bomb than Amy Klobuchar or Bernie Sanders or anybody else on that.
Or me or you. He can't do it. He can't do it.
It's yeah, or possible. Me or you.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. It's very, but here's where the Democrats, our hands are tied. And they play by, and this gets back to a David Ferris theory, they play by a set of rules that are written by Republicans. So the set of rules says you have to be tough to our quote-unquote adversaries, though it's not quite clear at any given time who an adversary is. They're forever changing. And Republicans write those rules but don't feel compelled to play by them. Donald John, for years we were told Russia's our adversary. Donald John Trump makes nice to Russia. That's out the window. So it's okay to be nice to Russia now?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Now 50% of Republican voters now say that Russia is an ally, not an adversary.
Wow. Okay, so there you go. So what if one of the Democratic candidates, when asked about, can you keep Tehran or Iran from having a bomb, said, "I don't agree with the premise. Of course we can't. What would that be?
What is the price that you're willing to pay to prevent it? Right? Like, we could. I mean, in theory, we could prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon if it was the most important thing in the world to us. If we wanted to launch a war against a country of 82 million people, you know, that's larger than Iraq, you know, that would keep our kids and our grandkids tied down there for 30, 40 years. Sure, we could do that, right? But it's an absurd contention. And I really, correct me if I'm wrong, but Bernie didn't get this question, right? Like it skipped over him.
Yeah, somehow or other missed Bernie.
And it's disappointing to me that no one had the opportunity. I don't know if Bernie would have done it or wouldn't have done it, but nobody had the opportunity to go out there and be like, you know, why is it that important to us whether Iran has or doesn't have a nuclear weapon? You know, like what's the baseline assumption here is that America gets to dictate to other countries the kinds of like military weapons that they have or they don't have. You know, there's no legal basis in the international community for telling the Iranians that they can't do X, Y, and Z, right? And I think the bigger issue here is that our obsession with Iranian nuclear weapons has brought us to the brink of a conflict that we don't need to have, you know? So President Trump thinks that he's diffused a situation, even though he escalated it. He destroyed the Iranian nuclear accord that we had with Iran. And so no one on stage was willing to question the premise of the moderator's view of this, which is like Iran is a huge threat to America. You know, like Buttigieg said it. I think Warren said it. It was like, of course, this is a huge threat to the American people if Iran gets a nuclear weapon. And it's like, well, why? You know, why is that exactly? I mean, just say it out loud, right? Like Pakistan has a nuclear weapon. We don't have like great relations with Pakistan. Russia has nuclear weapons. Like we don't have great relations with Russia. we're not all cowering in fear doing the, like, you know, get under the desk drills that my parents did when they were in grade school. Like, why couldn't we live with an Iranian nuclear weapon? And if you think it's such a threat, why did you destroy the deal that was, you know, at least putting it over the time horizon into, like, the 2030s where it could happen, you know? And so that is where it comes back to the moderation of the debate, where the question was framed in a way. Do you remember? It was like they were like, "What? You know, how would you do as commander in chief?"
Yes, they do it that way. Yeah.
You know, when you're in charge of murdering people, like, how many people will you murder? You know, it just, I just couldn't believe it. Like, it was just, it was shocking to me, the number of unexamined assumptions that were left on the table there, particularly because Democratic voters, maybe we'll get back to this, under the age of 35, like, are really opposed to all of this stuff in pretty decisive numbers, you know? And so the fact that none of the candidates were willing to challenge the assumptions of this policy and or the moderators' questions, I just was, you know,
well,
it really
because
turned out.
We'll get to back to that because that's the topic of a book you just wrote, The Political Attitudes of Voters Under the Age of 35. But we'll get back to that. But the underlying premise of the last night's debate, for certain, and the other debates too, as the way it's framed, is that Democrats are being put on the defensive, mm-hmm. as though they're being called to justify the values of the Democratic Party in a way that won't infuriate a swing voter, an imaginary swing voter, yeah. in Michigan. We don't even know who but this person's vision of a swing voter. So the worldview of the moderators who asked the question, David, is that Donald Trump has his voters. Democrats have their voters. The election will be decided in three states by swing voters. What can you do, Democrats, to assure those swing voters that you understand them? Forget everybody else. And yeah. That's the underlying assumption.
We don't matter. Yeah, we don't matter. And I also think it's just, you know, allowing the moderators to frame the whole election in those terms is really destructive to the party. You know, because if you were just tuning into the debate last night, the way it went was like, you know, candidate A, explain why you're not crazy. Candidate B, explain why you're not crazy. Candidate C, you're obviously not crazy. You know, tell us why. you know, and yeah. so the candidates who are presumed not crazy by the moderators of these debates
yeah.
are like Biden and Klobuchar.
Yeah.
And Biden, you know, just kind of can't get out of his own way rhetorically. It really concerns me. I feel like if anybody was up on the stage with that demeanor and that command of the language and that command of the issues,
yeah.
who was not Joe Biden, who was not the former VP to a popular former president, he would be like laughed off the yeah. stage. You know, people would be like, this guy does not have it together. You know, like he speaks in sentences and at the end of the sentence, he drops like a random word.
Yeah.
You know, they'd be
yeah.
like, so I think that, you know, we shouldn't have gotten ourselves into this fix, Trump, you know, and stuff like that, where it's like, I understand he's struggling with a speech problem, which is I have great sympathy for. People with disabilities, I'm sure, have great sympathy for. But it's not encouraging to me that like Joe Biden's childhood malady is coming back to haunt
Actually,
him on a national stage.
Just,
it's not great.
I just want to say this about that. Somebody else said this in today's show earlier. Monroe, I think, said, I've watched Joe Biden for many years.
Yeah, he was not like this.
He was not like this.
No.
Joe Biden did the reason why he's in my five, I have a top five, and he's on there. I remember him mopping the floor with the Paul Ryan.
Oh yeah, that was great.
I remember how he stood up to Sarah Palin. On the other side, conversely, I remember him flawlessly leading the Judicial Committee hearings regarding Clarence Thomas. And this is a different man. This is not, you cannot blame this on a childhood affliction with stuttering.
No.
This is a man, I've seen him at the top of his game, okay, David? And this is, he's not at the top of his game.
No, he's at the bottom of his game, yeah. and it's very concerning to me. I mean, the only thing that I can say in his defense is that, like, presidents don't spend their time debating. You know, it's a little bit crazy, actually, that we spend this much time talking about debates, because ultimately, once you become president, you don't debate anymore.
Well, here's
the end.
Okay, here's why. Two things. One, I've covered Chicago politics long enough to know, to come to the realization that voters do not hold it against a leader if that leader is inarticulate.
Yeah.
I've seen Chicagoans elect inarticulate mayors time after time after time. I remember Dan Quayle in the 1992 debate. I thought the guy was a bumbling idiot, and it didn't seem to bother voters. They voted for George Bush and Dan Quayle. So inarticulateness has never really been a deterrent. Where these debates is important, in my humble opinion, get your thoughts on this, is it sets the tone for the party. So what issues are the party going to champion? What declarations will the party make to the people, the voters out there, that would encourage them to vote? I would say the reason why Donald Trump benefited from the Republican debates that took place in 2016 is that he did not care what the moderators asked. Mm-hmm. He gave his answers, and that was the first step toward presenting him as a unique candidate, different than any other candidate before him. And I wish the Democrats would show a little bit of, I hate to say it, that Trump-like attitude of indifference.
I mean, he was his authentic self in those debates, right? If we could agree that he was Donald Trump, you know, he didn't care about, you know, sort of party conventions or like norms about what you can say and you can't say. Mm-hmm. What I would say about these debates is that the Democratic Party is a political organization, right? It sets its own rules, it sets its own procedures, right? And it has a lot of decisions to make about how it presents these debates to the world, you know? And what they've done right now is they've sort of subcontracted their most important sort of forward-facing events to a series of organizations that don't care about them, you know? I mean, the journalists all may be, you know, center-left, right? Like, I don't doubt that all the moderators from last night, you know, Blitzer and what was her name? I don't
remember the names. I didn't know the names.
She really annoyed me. I don't doubt that they're all like center left. They'll all vote for the Democratic nominee.
I don't know if that's true, actually, but whatever. Let's work from that assumption.
Like 90% of them. You know?
Okay.
But there's no law that says that Democrats have to say to MSNBC and CNN that you get to ask whatever questions you want. And it comes back to your point about the issues that come up in these debates and the way that they are presented to the public. You know, and it's like, what did The question on the DNC's mind when they were thinking about how do we present our candidates to the public and how do we help the public sort of navigate between the different people that are running for president should be like, what do we want our voters to be thinking about when they make this choice, right? And instead, what they get is like, what do media elites want them to be thinking about, you know? And media elites seem to relentlessly want people to think about how horrible it would be if we spent money to help ordinary people.
Yeah.
You know? And it's just like every question in the debates is like shot through with this contempt for the idea that we should spend national resources to help, you know, to help people that are struggling or to help middle-class Americans or working-class Americans or poor people, you know? No one thinks like maybe the $800 billion we spend a year on defense could be reallocated, you know, by 25 or 30% to do other things with our time and our money. And so the whole primary from beginning to end, because most people are paying attention to and making decisions about this primary based on these debates, more so in the past than now, but like particularly in the beginning, people do make decisions about who to support based on these debates. It's incredible. And it's an incredible, awesome responsibility for the people conducting those debates. Well, and I don't think they've taken it seriously.
Well, enough. Again, when you say that people make their decisions, who they're going to vote for based on these debates, I've not been paying attention to the ratings. I didn't see the ratings last night. Did you see it? By any chance, see the ratings?
I haven't seen anything about ratings. Okay. I assume they're a little bit better than December because that happened on the same day as some impeachment stuff.
Okay. Yes.
They finally had the kind of the stage to themselves last night.
Right.
You know?
And they only had six people on the stage. Yeah. What a curious assortment of six they had. What Tom Steyer is doing, and that's a whole other story.
Tom Steyer's
presence on the stage is baffling in so many ways, how the rules end up allowing him to be on the stage. But again, I'll put it to you this way. I'll rephrase it. The media, what you call the media elites, are very concerned, and this is where the Republicans, this is a David Ferris idea that I'm repackaging. The Republicans have been very astute at doing in politics what coaches in the NBA do every day at a basketball game. They play the referees. They whine about every single call that goes against them in the hopes that the next call goes for them. So Republicans have very successfully put media outlets on the defensive that somehow or other they are pro-Democrat. And you actually, David Ferris, played into that by saying your guess is that those three people are going to vote are centrist, they're going to vote Democrat. I don't know what Wolf Blitzer votes, so I wouldn't take that bet. But the point is that there's this underlying assumption that the media elites are in favor of the Democrats, so then they, the media elites, bend over backwards to show they're quote-unquote open-minded, and so what really concerns them are things like, how are you going to pay for that health care thing, you know?
Right, like this many trillion dollars, you know? Trillions of dollars.
Trillions of dollars.
Trillions.
Yeah, with a T.
As if we don't spend trillions of dollars every single year, right? Like, it's not that big of a deal.
On something, yeah. So that's what they're doing. And what bothers me about the Democrats is they never fight back. They never say, I disagree with the premise of... I think Bernie may have said that once in one debate.
No, he's done it a few times He's like, your question is wrong. Last night, I really liked it when he was getting grilled about trade, right?
Yeah.
And they were like, why won't you vote for the USMC, whatever it's called, NAFTA Part 2.
Yeah, NAFTA Part 2, yeah.
And he was like, I want to talk about the climate. And she was like, no, Senator, I want to stay on trade. And he was like, it's all the same issue. You know what I mean? It's all the same. It's all one issue.
Yes, right? It is.
Which I really liked. And so I think more than anyone else, he has actually
more than anyone
moderators.
Else. Yeah. Yeah.
But most people take the questions at face value because they're afraid of getting into a confrontation with the moderators, because that generally has not gone that well. If you remember Mitt Romney getting into it with Candy Crowley in 2012 about Benghazi and Libya and stuff, you know? And she was like, actually, Governor, you know, this is what happened. And Romney was like,
Habita.
Let me consult my dog on the roof. So they don't want to do it. You know, they don't want to get into it with one of these journalists because they think it won't go well. They won't go well for them, which I understand.
Which is probably true.
But
Trump does not seem to be bothered by that.
No, he doesn't. No, but I mean, at the same time, Donald Trump's approval rating is like probably 15% below where it should be based on the economy. You know,
so there is a price he is paid.
There is a price. Everyone is like, what a genius he is. You know, like he got elected. He can't. You know, he's incapable of punting away the support of the 42% of the people that support him, right? And I'm like, let's look at this another way, right? Which is like, I don't know, things are pretty good, you know? I mean, they're not perfect. We have the same challenges we had 4 years ago in terms of housing costs and healthcare costs. But I think, like, you know, most people would say the economy is better than it was 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. I don't credit this guy for it, but he's there in the office taking credit for it. And he's incapable of capitalizing on that by building a broader coalition than he has, you know? So it's like, we don't want to be like Trump in the sense that we want to like deliberately alienate.
That's a valid point.
Anyone that's not in our corner.
Yeah.
Right.
Although Donald Trump seems indifferent. I'll put it this way. I don't want to lose this point because this is something I've been thinking about. I don't think I've ever put it together. Donald Trump seems largely indifferent to the economy. If you think about all the subjects that goad him into responding or making a statement, it's like the economy is an afterthought. He'll like tweet, greatest economy ever. And then there'll be like 50 tweets about Nancy Pelosi or
Rosie O'Donnell, whoever he hates at the moment.
He really doesn't care about the economy. Greatest stock market ever. And then, I hate Rosie O'Donnell, you know.
He's rich and everyone he knows is rich. It doesn't matter to him, right? Like it could be the economy could be crashing or it could be doing really, really well. It doesn't matter to him. If it's crashing, he'll like contact some gangsters in Moldova and be like, can you save my casino? If it's doing well, he's like, that's great, I'm doing well too. But fundamentally, he's not going to end up on the street, right? He's never really cared about any of this stuff.
So you're right. I guess he's not a role model, but I will say that, like I said, he took control of the debates in a way that no Democrat does. He made that his own personal plaything.
I want you to imagine a different kind of debate universe than the one that we have. And I've made this point a number of times in the last year. So instead of sort of subcontracting your questions, your ideas, your presentation to CNN, you know, and there's a lot of great people that work for CNN. You know, I don't like impugn them. I have some friends there. But instead of doing that, the DNC says, we're going to run our own debates. Okay. We're going to have a bunch of, you know, like experts on these issues, you know, like a climate change expert, Bill McKibben. We're going to have Bill McKibben run a climate change debate. And we're going to invite CNN and MSNBC and Fox to come if they want, but we'll stream it on our own channel, thedemocrats.com. You know what I mean? Like you take the power of these media elites out of the questioning in your debates, and you set the terms yourself, right? And whoever you choose to moderate that debate, you say to them, like, look, you know, we want you to get at the differences between our candidates, but your goal is not to make them look bad. You know, your goal is not to make the Democratic Party look crazy and put it on the defensive so that everyone is thinking, when they leave the, you know, when they turn the debate off, they're not thinking like, oh, man, I don't know if that we should... Maybe Joe Biden is the, you know, Joe Biden. I feel like Joe Biden has been positioned as the person who will functionally do nothing, right? Where it's like, everything's kind of fine. We just want to get rid of this dude, right? Like the orange-haired guy, I want to get rid of him and replace him with this guy that can't speak in complete sentences. Like, would that be okay with you? Right? Like, that's where we're headed.
Yeah.
Because right? Everyone, they're like, whoa, you know, like Bernie and Lizzie's ideas are too radical. None of the others can really get any traction. I mean, Mayor Pete, I think, is on his way out. Maybe that's wishful thinking.
Why do you say that?
He's dropped a little bit in the polls over the last couple of weeks in the early states. And I, to me, he feels like a Herman Cain-y kind of like flavor of the month that on caucus day in Iowa. I mean, you know the dynamics of these caucuses, right? People like arguing.
Right.
If you don't get 50%, you got to release all your supporters to the other candidates. Yes. I feel like Mayor Pete is not going to do well in that situation, you know, where it's like when you really have to justify why you want him over the other ones. My suspicion is that he's going to do worse in Iowa than he thinks he is, and than his supporters think he is, and that's going to translate into sort of negative momentum in the other states.
Yeah. I, by the way, this is a tangent within a tangent. I'll just be open about this. I've not understood the appeal of Mayor Pete from the get-go on any level, and I've said this on the air. We've had guests on the show from South Bend who are very critical of him. But I'm also just like his attitude about, and he's sticking to it. It's going down with this ship. His attitude about not allowing wealthy people to be the beneficiaries of a aid to college somehow or other. He thinks he's making. Striking a point of fairness when he's completely ignoring the reality of the world, David, which is that if not everybody doesn't get a benefit, that benefit will be the first thing that gets whacked during hard times. But if rich people get a benefit, like Social Security, they're sticking to it. Okay,
yeah, they're fine with it.
That's the reality of the world. You want to help people in college, you got to help all people. So anyway, he thinks this is
The reality is rich people aren't going to go to those schools anyway, right? The rich people are going to keep going to Harvard and Stanford and Yale, right?
Some rich people will go to a public school.
Yeah, like a few.
A few, a relative. But so the point is, I don't know what he thinks, how he's going to win a Democratic nomination with his, you get what I'm saying? It's such a narrow appeal. It's like an appeal to Republicans. But then last night, I started reading about, I can't believe I spent so much time reading about his father. Pete Buttigieg's father is a professor at Notre Dame, an English professor. And his specialty was a communist thinker from Italy. And I'm reading...
Was it Gramsci?
Yeah, Gramsci. Yeah. And I'm reading about Gramsci. And I was like an hour reading about Gramsci. I'm like, this is fascinating to me that this moderate who's completely repackaging is trying to put a new position, make the Democrats, I don't know,
Democratic. He's a red diaper baby.
He's a red diaper.
Yes.
I'm like, what the hell? Paging Dr. Freud. Anyway, but so suddenly at the very end, I'm interested in Pete Buttigieg. But I just I'm baffled at why anybody would think that would be the way to go to win A, the Democratic nomination, and B, an election.
Yeah, I mean, I found him when he first got in the race. And he was talking about like court packing and stuff. I was like, okay, I'm listening. go on, you know, please proceed, Governor. And then the more he kind of cut to the right on a variety of issues. Yeah. He's not appealing. And I say it more that I listen to him. Of all the candidates on stage remaining, I feel like he has the most sort of like staged debate persona, with like the fake emotion, you know, where he's like, let us not think about the, you know, just, it's just like, I don't think that he really feels these things. I just think he wants to be president, which doesn't distinguish him from these other people. They all want to be president. Yeah. They're all ambitious.
Yes.
They all wanted to be president since they were like 35.
Yeah.
Right. Like, it's not like he's uniquely evil in that regard. He doesn't appeal to me personally. And I also think that he doesn't make very convincing cases for the policies that he's recommending. You know, it almost always comes back to like, you know, we don't have to do A or B. We could do C.
Yeah, you know? I know. Yeah.
But he doesn't really specify like what C is or how it would work or give me any evidence that he's thought about it.
No, all right, I don't want to spend any more time talking about it, but I'm like you. I've seen so many of these debates. I now can recognize his debate style, and I can see it. I know what he does. He's the master of the pivot. Mm-hmm. So he'll start off with a sort of a more or less direct answer to the question asked, and then almost as though his mind just went on a tangent. He'll go, but you know, and then he'll pivot. And so he'll leave the world of the question behind and go to Pete world, wherever he thinks that'll help him. And I've said this many times, I'm ashamed of my fellow baby boomers. As I understand it, his campaign is propped up by baby boomers. And baby boomers, I hate to say it, you've been suckered in by a nice guy who carries your groceries to the car. Oh, what a nice young man! He carried my groceries. That's Mayor Pete. Oh,
yeah, like, are you married? Are you married? You have some granddaughters that would love to.
No, he'd be like, oh my God, you guys sisters? He says it to the mom, to the daughter. You guys gotta be sisters.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right. Enough.
That's the vibe. Very strong vibe I've always gotten from him.
Yeah, he's Eddie Haskell, which is a reference to an old sitcom. All right. So. You laid out what you an ideal debate format that you would like to see the Democrats embrace. Let me talk about this. Who's on the stage? Last night, six candidates, all white, two women, four men. There was one billionaire on the stage. Somebody wisecracked that there was more billionaires on the stage than there were black people, even though the Democratic Party base is the black population of this country.
That's important.
Very important. You wouldn't know it from last night's debate. And so when you look back from the start to where we are now, what's your opinion as to how it is that we had the six people that we have? Like, these are the six people. And with Bloomberg knocking on the door, another billionaire.
Bloomberg, the demon lurking in the room. I think the DNC is in it. It's in some ways a difficult position, right? Like, we're in this like post Citizens United universe where you can spend $1 trillion of your own money and you can do whatever you want, you know? And the party has to be seen as being fair. You know, like, that's the most important thing, I think, for the DNC for this cycle, given what happened in 2016, was that when people are talking about the debate rules and who ended up on stage at the end of the day, and they're like, I wish that Booker was up there instead of Steyer. I wish that Harris was up there instead of Buttigieg. But when they're sitting at the bar, they're like, but you know, like, those were the rules, right? Like, everybody knew the rules in advance. And, you know, Klobuchar got the polls and she got the money and Booker didn't. Mm-hmm. And so that's fair. So when I look at the debate stage, it's not the six people that I would like to be up there, you know. It's like three people that I would like to be up there and three people that I would like to like fire into the center of the sun and never see again, you know. I miss Cory Booker. I liked him, you know. He had a sort of a checkered past in terms of his support for some school choice
charter
stuff.
Schools.
Charter schools, mm-hmm. Yeah. I know a couple of people that would never consider him for those reasons, but I think in terms of his voting record in Congress and then his persona on the debate stage, I found him to be a very appealing character. I would have voted for him, I would have considered voting for him, mm-hmm. right? And I wanted to hear more from him, particularly because it's not a very diverse field, right? And I feel like Cory Booker has some experiences and some appeal to certain constituencies in the party that's very important, and he's not there, right? But the party made this decision that's like, we're going to set these ground rules. I don't care whether you're, you know, you're Black, Latina, woman, that you either make this cut or you don't, mm-hmm. you know? And to me, the most problematic person on stage right now is Steyer, you know? And Steyer is a creature of the Citizens United world, where he's lighting his money on fire to get to 9% in the polls in South Carolina or whatever it is. He's not viable. He's not going to win. But he makes the cut over and over and over again, you know? And as opposed to the old days, where if you got 2% in Iowa, you went away.
Yeah.
Steyer can stay in it as long as he wants. Right? Like Bloomberg can stay in it as long as he wants. I don't understand what Bloomberg is doing, because like you want to win, you need to be at these debates, right? Like people need to be seeing you. It's not enough to run ads in every market. But I don't see a way, honestly, I don't see a way for the party to devise some kind of workaround that prevents rich people from getting into the debates while at the same time maintaining the idea that the same rules apply to everyone.
Yeah.
You know? And so in that sense,
that's a valid point. In other words, the same rules don't apply to everybody. If a rich person has access to a personal fortune that he or she can use to spend, but there are rules. I've forgotten. I used to know this, David. I'm a little embarrassed to say. It's like cramming for a test. I forgot the requirements that you have to, because there's a fundraising requirement and there is a poll requirement. I've momentarily forgotten. I'm blanking out. I humbly apologize.
So no, they've set different rules for each debate.
Yeah.
I think the current requirement is 4% in a number of national polls or 4% in some early state polls.
And but there's a fundraising as well.
Yeah, you have to have you know, X number of individual donors.
And so Tom Steyer has
and spread across a number of states.
And right. So even though he's largely bankrolling his campaign by himself, he's able to meet that threshold.
Right. Because I think one of the things people are not thinking about is that what rich people do is they use their money to meet those thresholds. Right. Like, so what Cory Booker was doing towards the end of the debates was like, you know, please give me money so that I meet these requirements.
Yes.
Please tell a pollster that you support me so that I meet these requirements. Whereas Steyer and Bloomberg, if Bloomberg wanted to, he could do this. They could just conjure this out of thin air, right? Like a billionaire, it's very easy for a billionaire to raise money. Right? A billionaire just takes out a bunch of ads on Facebook and is like, can you give me a buck? You know, and then, you know, enough people give him a buck that he's viable and he moves forward. Whereas the people that are not well-funded have to spend all of their campaign cash trying to raise money to meet the threshold to get into the debate so that they still seem viable. Mm. All of this is not the DNC's fault, right? This is the fault of our crazy campaign finance system. And this goes back almost 20 years to when primary candidates started saying, you know, we're not going to take the federal matching funds. We're not going to observe these limits. And it became this like Wild West, you know? And so the consequence of that is, you know, we have Tom Steyer up there instead of Kamala Harris or Cory Booker, who, you know, I'm not like an uncritical supporter of either of those candidates, but I thought they had more interesting things to say, more interesting stories and more appeal to our coalition than this old, you know, like gray-faced billionaire who doesn't have anything original to say. He's just like, I like what Elizabeth said is really, really nice. And what Bernie said was really good.
All right, here's, and I could say this as somebody who's watched every debate, has had discussions about every debate, read about every debate. I've brought in some of the smartest people in Chicago to discuss every debate. And let's get to Kamala Harris, and you already mentioned Cory Booker. They're not there because they could not win over Democratic voters, and that is the bottom line.
That's the bottom line, yeah.
Kamala Harris, she had that moment at that first debate, and I used to joke on the show, I'm drinking the Kamala Kool-Aid, I'm feeling Kamala, yeah. And then she allowed Tulsi Gabbard to knock her out in the next debate with Tulsi's question about her support of laws which threw Black people into jail for reefer. Mm-hmm. Ultimate double standard in criminal justice that's inexcusable in our day and age, but was more or less acceptable 20 years ago.
Sure.
And she had no defense of that, David. She had no way of countering it. she hasn't been the same since that, in my estimation.
I'll just disagree with you slightly about what I thought the turning point for her campaign was. She had that moment with Biden in the first debate, mm-hmm. Where she was like, I was a little girl and your policies hurt me and my family. And it was like, whew, shazam. And Biden did not react well, right? Everybody was already thinking, like, Biden doesn't really have it together. And he can't respond to this, like, very simple.
Yeah.
He can't be magnanimous in this, like, very simple way where he was like, he could have been like, I've rethought things. And, of course, I wouldn't want to do anything to your family that would, whatever. Mm-hmm. I may still not agree with these particular busing policies. Like, why was busing? Whatever. Yeah. But she walked it back.
That's true.
Like the next day, she was like, somebody was like, "Do you support mandatory busing?" She was like, "No."
Yeah.
And she walked, and so she got tagged more so than the sort of like you're a cop thing. I feel like she got tagged as inauthentic.
Yes, you're right. Because she also walked back. Now that I think about it, this is probably more brutal to her reputation than Tulsi Gabbard. You're right. Remember, she walked back whether she supported health care for immigrants, illegal immigrants.
Yeah.
Remember they were asked, raise your hand if you support.
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought there were key moments where she didn't seem to know what she thought. Right. Which is, to be honest with you, a totally like normal human thing.
Yeah.
To be like, I don't know what I think about this issue. Like, I feel like if you're, a competent adult, and you want to be taken seriously, you should rethink your assumptions every once in a while. But she seemed like she was rethinking her assumptions about like critical issues, like sort of on the fly, which I don't think was appealing to anyone in the Democratic coalition. So it's like if she had taken clear positions from the get-go, I think she would have done better. The other thing is like, she had raised a bunch of money. She spent a bunch of money. It's not like she was getting blown away by Steyer and Bloomberg, and that's why she went away. Like, she went away before Steyer or Bloomberg really went up on the air and started blitzing people with these ads. I think ultimately, the gatekeepers of the Democratic nomination are African-American voters in a lot of different states. I mean, we go first with Iowa and New Hampshire, and that's its whole other story. And it's messed up the way we give these, like, super white states this say in the early nomination. But in the national polling period, before Iowa and New Hampshire vote, and I think people pay much more attention to the national numbers than they do to the Iowa and New Hampshire numbers, Harris couldn't get any traction.
Yes.
And Booker couldn't get any traction, primarily because African-American voters were sticking with Biden, and that's not, that's not something for me, that, these two white dudes in this room right now to psychologize or I don't know why. It's not for me to decide because it's not my vote, but ultimately, if African-American voters wanted Harris or Booker in this race still, they would still be there because they dropped out for polling reasons, not for fundraising.
Fair enough. You're absolutely correct. And I've had this debate repeatedly with various people of all races as to why the black vote is so has been so strong with Joe Biden. And the answer inevitably comes back to one word, Obama. Mm-hmm. Joe Biden was his wingman. Joe Biden stood by him. Joe Biden was there for 8 years.
And I think there's a certain pragmatism.
Yes.
And the African-American voting community, it's like millions of people, right? But like, I think there's a sense of, we don't want necessarily radical change that will invite a backlash.
Okay.
And
let me repeat what I said. And I have never seen in all my years of covering politics in the city of Chicago a candidate punished for being inarticulate. And that crosses all racial and ethnic boundaries. I've seen inarticulate white guys, including many mayors that we've had, and inarticulate black guys, inarticulate Hispanic guy, and they get reelected and people like them. There's something genuine. So when Joe Biden stumbles through a sentence, and as you said, and people are like, yeah, I like him.
Well, I mean, normal people can't do this, right? Nor should they be able to. Like, if you pulled someone out of a machine shop and you're like, go speak for 90 minutes about healthcare, they'd be like, I don't, the way that people speak. I mean, run the transcript of this show, right?
Yeah,
like
we're
constantly stopping and like saying other things. And so, honestly, the way that Pete Buttigieg speaks is like way more alien to most people's experience of like conversation and how they themselves would speak in front of a crowd than how Joe Biden speaks.
Absolutely.
You know, and so why it's like terrifying to me
and
that Biden is this inarticulate at this stage of the primary. Yeah. I don't think it turns that many people. This is what I've concluded. People don't care.
They don't care. Oh my God, David, they don't care. I tell you, I think I had this conversation with you. Who can remember? Over Thanksgiving, this kid and I we took great delight at listening to the. It was late at night, and a few drinks had been consumed, and we were listening. This is what no life I have. Listening to Joe Biden's responses to various questions during debates, including the classic one about the record player.
Yeah.
Oh man, play it again, man.
Yeah, that was my favorite.
Like playing it over.
You gotta
and over.
Put the record player on at night so the kids learn the language.
Yeah, man. But a lot of people are like, yeah, it makes sense to me.
Yeah.
It sounds like something my father used to say. So, all right. So that's where we are with the debates. Let's talk briefly before we move on to Iran. Handshake Gate. That, of course, is the fight that's brewing between Bernie and Elizabeth Warren over whether he said in a private conversation in 2018, as she asserts, that a woman can't be elected president, or whether he did not say it. They got so testy last night that she refused to accept his hand in a handshake. And Twitter's been blowing up ever since, with supporters of each candidate fighting, because Democrats love fighting with each other.
Love to fight.
They love to fight because it's easier to beat up a Democrat than to beat Donald Trump. So ultimately, Democrats are chicken and they fight each other. All right, your thoughts on Handshake Gate?
This is one of those feuds where it just seems like it would be so easy to defuse. And ultimately, I feel like responsibility lies with the two candidates for not doing it, you know? You know, Bernie could have said something like, I don't remember saying that. But I, of course, like many Americans, given what happened in 2016, I worry that, that a woman would have a harder time against Trump just because of, you know, misogyny and all, you know, just say a bunch of buzzwords that appeal to Democrats, you know, right? Like institutionalized misogyny, you know, mean it or don't mean it.
Yeah.
But like, he could have just said like,
words that appeal to
I don't remember
Democrats.
Saying that, but I might have said something like, you know, like many people, I honestly think that maybe a guy would do better, and maybe he wouldn't. I don't know, but it's something I worry about.
Yeah.
You know, and Elizabeth Warren could have said something like, you know, I remember you saying this, but of course, you know, Bernie, I know that you don't think that a woman can't be elected president.
Yeah.
Like, I know that you don't think that. That's not what your record says. And then she could have shaken his hand after the debate. You know, I'm a Warren 1, Bernie 2 guy, right? I have been from the beginning. But I didn't like that moment at the end of the debate. Like, she knew she was on camera, you know?
She was. So you think she was trying to humiliate him a little bit?
I don't know if it was intentional or not. Again, I always try to emphasize to people when they watch these debates, all these people are people.
Wait, time out. Hold on. You can't have it both ways. I'm going to be tough like a debate person.
Yeah, do it.
All right.
How will you pay for this, David?
Yeah.
How will you pay for this?
How are you going to pay for the health care that we all need?
You're going to pay for this.
We don't forget the $738 billion defense fund. But how are you going to pay for that health care? All right. No, you just got finished saying she knew she was on camera. If she knew she was on camera, then it was intentional. If she knew she's on camera and they're filming her, he puts his hand out and she doesn't take it. She knows they're watching. Either she doesn't know she's on camera or she does know she's on camera.
No, that's true. I mean, I think they all know they're on camera,
yeah.
Right? And so I think they have to be careful and cognizant of what that means. But I also think it's, I said this during the 2016 debates when Donald Trump was doing all this crazy stuff to Hillary, you know, and I was like, whatever you think of Hillary, like just, I mean, I get, honestly, Ben, like, I get flustered when people yell at me, like, people I love, you know, like, when my wife is like, why did you do this? Like, why didn't you buy the presents for your family? Like, you said you would do it before Christmas, you know? And I'm like, oh, God. And I like, start sweating from my armpits, and I turn into a puddle. And can you imagine being up in front of 100 million people? 100 million people.
No, could not in a million years imagine.
And somebody's like, what do you think about, you know, like, you're the commander-in-chief, David. What are you going to do about X, Y, and Z? And I'm like, Jesus Christ, I have no idea, right? I'll just melt away.
Yeah.
So the fact that any of these people can do any of this stuff, I think, is actually quite impressive.
Yes.
You know? All that being said, I do think that Warren missed an opportunity to kind of bury this, you know?
Yeah. She should have shaken his hand.
Yeah. She should have said, like, you know, this is how I remember it, but obviously I don't think that you meant it, and it's not a big issue. And they did the obligatory kind of try to paper it over, but neither of them actually went far enough to end the feud in terms of their supporters, like particularly on Twitter, which was like a derailment last night. Like, you know, it was like such a mess. Yeah. You know, like all the Bernie people were tweeting like snakes at Elizabeth Warren, and it was like, why do we have to live through this?
Hashtag CNN is trash.
Hashtag never Warren. You know, like this kind of stuff. Mostly, which I think is not driven by actual Bernie supporters. It's like a Russian influence operation, et cetera. But I think that the best way that they could have resolved that would be to say, like, look, you know, it was 2 years ago. We might have slightly different memories of this. You know, Bernie, you think I could win, right? And he could be like, yeah. So you think I will make a win? Yeah. And Elizabeth Warren could have said, like, you know, I know that you wanted me to run in 2015. There's, you know, Bernie was like, there's this video of me saying this 30 years ago, right? Like, just they got so close to burying it, and then they didn't bury it. And I feel like that was really destructive in ways that makes me very frustrated with both of them.
Well, first of all, because in my cynical, I've been covering Chicago politics long, two view of the world. Two things happened. One, Bernie began whispering to people in Iowa that Elizabeth Warren is an elite to try to accentuate her negatives among Democrats to win. And so this is an important counter issue for Elizabeth Warren to accentuate Bernie's negatives, which is that women don't like the Bernie bros, and good reason, because some of them are so freaking obnoxious.
Yeah.
And they all pretend as though they're above it all, but really they're playing dirty politics. They went low because they figured this is how you win an election, and now here we are, typical Democrats, fighting each other.
Well, I mean, some of this is it's just built into the equation, because I think I wrote a piece like a year ago where I said, look, neither Bernie or Elizabeth is going to win the nomination with them both in the race.
Yeah,
like one of them's got to get out of the way. I still think that. Yeah. Is that the path to the nomination run through each other.
Yeah.
And maybe you could make an argument that if Warren could get Buttigieg out of the race, she might be able to catch up with Biden, but I don't think it's enough. You know, like Biden's got enough of a lead, particularly in the Super Tuesday states, that it's just hard for me to see either of them winning the nomination unless the other gets out. Wow. Now, one of them will get out, right? I mean, eventually. It's a question of the timing.
Yeah.
You know, like if they both stay in and they pull collectively 32% of the vote and Biden gets 35% of the vote, and they're splitting delegates and he's racking them up, you know, then where are we? And there's no like moral or there's no moral case to be made to either of them that they should get out. But that's the reality. I just don't think that either of them can win with both of them in the race.
Yeah. You may be right. But the reality, I just had a smile thinking about it. Joe Biden debating Donald Trump.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine?
I just imagine. I'll mop the floor with you. I mean, that's the
But they would neither of them be able to, like, say the sentences, you know? Like, did you see Trump's press conference after the Soleimani thing when, you know, the Iranians fired back and he went out? He looked like he sounded like he had been given a tranquilizer.
Yeah.
You know, he was like, Iran will never have a nuclear weapon. Good morning, everyone. You know, it was like he didn't even know what sequence his speech should take place in. You know,
it sounded like he just went up a flight of steps, like three flights of steps.
Yeah, he was out of it, man. And like, I don't know if you've ever heard like two super old people yell at each other for 3 hours. But that's what Trump and Biden would be like.
I get Israel. Last night's debate, the most surreal moment. Talk about older people dealing with each other, occurred. Elizabeth Warren said, it was her great comeback. She said, I'm the only person on this stage who's defeated an incumbent Republican in the last 30 years. So there's a little caveat, last 30 years. All right. Clearly, that was a prepared remark, but ran through the lawyers and the mathematicians on the Elizabeth Warren campaign, because Bernie defeated an incumbent in 1990.
Right.
But that was 30 years ago, right?
I know, 29 years and 2 months, if you're going to get particular about it, right?
So then Bernie goes, oh, I defeated an incumbent. And she goes, I said 30 years. It's like all of a sudden she's a lawyer, you know, 30. And he's looking at her like, are you freaking crazy?
Yeah,
they're just staring.
And they're both like, I got to check my Hotmail account. I have some notes about this in a file, a clippings. I have some clippings from the newspaper that I'm going to send my grandkids.
No, they just... that was like, oh my God, that was
get
a surreal
younger
moment.
Get younger, all of you. Lord.
All right, let's move on to a far more serious matter. Iran, I don't even know where to begin with this one, David.
It's terrifying. I have some like weirdly interesting insights into this because I'm married into an Iranian-American family. Okay. My wife is Iranian-American. Mm-hmm. Iran is like the place on the earth that I would like most like to visit before I die. And so as long as this regime is in place, like I don't get to do that. And it's depressing and I hate these guys. It's a terrible government that does terrible things. And at the same time, I find myself just completely puzzled by the bipartisan sort of hysteria about Iran that has like gripped this country for the last 30 years. I feel like future historians are going to look back at the strongest military power in the world, like spending enormous amounts of its political time and capital, you know, losing its mind over this very minor regional military power and what it's up to. It just doesn't make any sense. It's emotional, you know. And Trump, like a lot of Republicans, approaches this from this emotional place of wanting to beat them, mm-hmm. you know, of like wanting to vanquish the Islamic Republic, you know, revenge for the hostages. Remember, he would like threaten to blow up 52.
Yes, he did.
Iranian cultural sites.
Yeah, one cultural site for each hostage that was held back in 1979.
Yeah, ask the hostages whether that's what they want.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's just, I feel like the whole debate that we have in America about Iran is just so totally divorced from like strategic reality and like the needs of the United States. You know, again, all the Democratic candidates who spoke on this issue sort of uncritically reflected back to the moderators the idea that an Iranian nuclear weapon would be an imminent threat to the American people, right? And it's like, well, which American people? And it's like, they're not gonna be able to reach us with a missile for another 30 years, et cetera, right? And then you get to take this logic all the way out. But, I keep coming back to the one thing I did agree with they all said, which was like, we had a deal in place that was working. Trump trashed it because he's an idiot. and here we are, you know, here we are in this big, stupid, unnecessary crisis. Yeah. And I feel like that's a theme with Trump, is he takes these issues and he like, you know, he creates a little crisis that he then resolves back to the status quo, you know? So it's like, if I came up, where do you live? I came up to your house, I set it on fire, and I was like, hey, I got the hose here, I'm gonna put it out. We cool? You know what I mean? Like, I'm a hero, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So he goes around, he sets these little fires, he puts them out, he sets them back on, and it all just increasingly feels like theater to me. The thing that I really fear about Trump and Iran is I believe the president does not want a war with Iran. You know, I say a lot of things about him. I do think he understands instinctively that starting a major new war in the Middle East in an election year, not a good idea.
Right.
You know, for him politically, it's not going to work.
Forget what it might do to the people in the Middle East.
Forget all this other stuff about morality and like what we've done to Iran and colonialism and all this stuff. Forget all that. Yeah. Just think about the election.
Yeah.
It's not good. He knows that. You know, but I feel like he's gotten so arrogant that he thinks he can do anything to anyone without actually starting the conflagration that he wants to avoid. And so he's like, oh, I can just murder a senior Iranian military official and nothing will happen. And the fact that, you know, very little seems to have happened just reinforces the tendency inside the White House to think that they can just like poke and prod and start these little fights with people, and then nothing will ever happen with it.
Yeah. You know? By the way, I just want to say, I know what you're saying. When very little has happened of consequence to people in this country, just the things off the top of my head that I can think that have happened to people in Iran, at the funeral, there was a stampede, and I forget how many people were died. And then the Iranians shot down
the plane.
A plane, and about 150 people died on that plane. So people have paid a consequence. I knew as soon as Trump ordered the execution of that general, David, somebody would pay a consequence. Probably would not be Donald Trump or anybody Donald Trump cares about, if he cares about anyone. But somebody was going to pay a consequence.
No, it's going to be innocent people in the Middle East. Yes. And there's 40 years of American foreign policy in the Middle East. Where we don't care about the consequences of our policies for ordinary human beings, that we can't meet at a Dhaka somewhere or negotiate an oil deal or something. You know, there's a Middle East scholar named Asad Abu Khalil, and 10-15 years ago, wrote this essay where he said that the two kinds of people in the world, right? There's expensive people and there's cheap people. You know, and sort of the Arabs and Iranians are cheap people to us. You know, like they can die in whatever numbers that we want them to die in. It doesn't matter. It doesn't affect us. And we don't feel any like moral sort of compulsion to care about them, you know? And maybe some of that's just like human nature. But it's also, it points to a problem with our foreign policy, right? Where when we talk about these crippling sanctions that we put on Iran and tightening the noose and, you know, like starving them and like, you know, like the things that we're trying to do to the Iranian people, mm-hmm. economically, everyone's just like, well, yeah, I mean, obviously, we don't want them to have a nuke, right? So let's just kill them all. Yeah. And it's a really sort of like staggeringly immoral stance to say, like, I'm going to make 40 million people suffer to achieve this geostrategic goal of mine. That's actually quite debatable, right? This is not like Nazi Germany, right? This is not a country that's about like overrun the world, right? Like this is a regional power that's exerting its influence largely among other sort of Shia Muslim populations in different parts of the Middle East. Its appeal is limited, you know, like the ideology of the Islamic Republic does not travel anywhere where you don't have large numbers of Shia Muslims. Right? So the threat of Iranian expansionism is like dementedly overblown. And so what you really have is just like this nuisance, right? You have a country that's like not cooperating with your goals in the Middle East. You know, that they're engaging in various little proxy wars, none of which affect ordinary people in America, really. And so it just all comes back to, like, can we not all just take a collective step back on Iran and be like, what are we doing here? You know, like, what is the goal of all of this? Why can't we ratchet down the tensions here? Why can't we step back and say, like, what is important to us and what is not important to us? And that's where I feel like... I have a lot of problems with Obama's foreign policy, you know, from the flying robots that murder people to the Afghanistan surge to Libya. But the one place where I feel like Obama was really forward thinking in a way that we'll appreciate long time from now, not right now, is his basic instinct that was like, why do we like the Saudis more than the Iranians?
There's no rhyme or reason to it.
Doesn't make any sense, right? Like, they're not worse than the Saudis. Saudis are like, Saudi Arabia is like arguably the worst government on earth, you know, and so why do we just sort of emotionally align ourselves with this one country over its rival in ways that keep drawing us into the Middle East, right? Like all these little Gulf Arab kingdoms that I've spent time in some of these places, you know, I'm not like sort of throwing things around in like a racist fashion, you know, like I'm a Lebanese descent. I have sympathy for some of this stuff, but like, why do we need to provide security for the Kuwaitis? Right. And that's another sort of like, that is a genius of Donald Trump, where he's like, why should I pay you protection? You know, why should I protect you without any money back? Pay me.
You know? Donald Trump, pay me.
Pay me. You know,
he wants his.
Yeah. Pay me. I'll give you some troops. Just pay me.
Yeah.
You know, it's very transactional. But I think that the long run result of that is if you get the American people thinking transactionally and like, what are we getting out of every single relationship that we have? Eventually people are going to look at like Iran and Saudi Arabia and all this stuff and be like, I don't even understand what's at stake here anymore. Honestly, like, it doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, I think it's just in like a fundamental way. What the driving force, and it's just symbolized by those questions ending where we started. Is that somehow or other, I don't know, our manhood is at stake, mm-hmm. our reputation is at stake.
We can't let them get the last word,
right?
Right. Which is just, it's just, it's not a way to conduct foreign policy.
No.
And my fear is that the one thing that Trump has continued with that he inherited from his predecessors, which doesn't make any sense, is that he has decided that a nuclear weapon is a red line. And what he has done from the beginning of his presidency is he has made it much more likely that Iran will sort of try to crash into a nuclear weapon.
And let me say this
and
about
that's what's really dangerous.
Donald
here.
Trump, he's perfectly capable of flipping. Tomorrow he could come out and it just be, it's just like with North Korea. Just substitute North Korea for Iran. This was the rhetoric coming out of Trump about North Korea, with the Rocket Man tweets and stuff.
All Khamenei needs to do, right? The supreme leader of Iran, it just needs to call up Trump and be like,
"What a great
guy, Donald, I stayed in one of your hotels, man. I stayed in the one in Azerbaijan. It's so beautiful. What a gorgeous facility. Do you want to talk? You know? What a classy man you are." And Trump would be like, "Wow, he loves me."
Yeah.
You
know?
Like, because the Iranians could be smart about this too. Like, all they gotta do is flatter this idiot, and he'll be like, "Oh, whatever you want. Yeah. You want nukes? I'll give you nukes.
Yeah,
it's all right. Here they are.
Yeah, here they are.
Pay me."
And right. And then he'll pick another country.
Yeah.
We should close this down. And I had all the things on the list, including,
we never have enough time, Ben.
No, we never have enough time. The kids are all left. David Ferris's next book, which we'll talk about the next time he's on. We didn't even get into impeachment, the strategy. Nancy Pelosi, you blew it. You didn't listen to David Ferris.
Didn't listen to me.
Drag it out all year. The articles of impeachment were sent over to the Senate today, and you know as well as I do, that kangaroo court.
No, it's over. I mean, nobody ever. Nobody ever listens to me. Back, so that's just you. I know. I appreciate that.
One. All right. Very good. David Ferris is his name. I love when he's on the show. And I guess we'll bring you back next month. I don't know if there's another debate, but we'll bring you back anyway.
Once a month. I'm in, Ben. I'm in.
Very good. David Ferris is his name. I'm Ben Jarofsky. And that's another bonus show. Take care, everybody.